offers up emotional energy. But Don will also state that it's important for one's vocation to have significant profitability, and this in turn can be altered by one's enthusiasm and ability to sell. Unfortunately, this can be overestimated when strong love of a product blinds its creator. That's precisely why everyone needs objective third parties to evaluate ideas. Trusted advisors, often enlightened CPAs or attorneys, are very valuable resources. They have experience in separating emotion from economic reality. One of Don's main advisors is his accountant. Following Don's discussion about emotional energy, another respondent made a valuable contribution to the interview. He defined other reasons for Don's success. You have the best description of your product. You did a wonderful job of explaining your company, your technology, and how your products work. You understand the technology, the fit in the market, and how it's going to benefit somebody else. Some people fall in love with a particular product idea, and that love can bias our own assessment of market demand. Don's love is not only for product concepts. His emotion is firmly rooted in his accurate estimate of the market's strong need for his product. His motivation is a direct result of envisioning buyers being able to solve problems with his technology. And that is, in essence, why he is a success today. He has great empathy for the needs of the market, and he is literally thrilled when his technology fills these needs. The market environments in America are very democratic. They reward people like Don who fill a need. And it doesn't matter Don is tall or short, wide or narrow, male or female, white or black. This is especially true in the entrepreneurial environment. But it also applies in situations where employees are paid on the basis of performances, such as in full commission sales positions. The market does not care. So what if a person worked for 9 other companies, did not receive all A's in college, and never read Amy Vanderbilt's book on etiquette? As another respondent stated in the same focus group, I think the irony of it all is that you don't have to look like the corporate guys who have to look good. Don agreed that corporations hire executives who are ambassadors. They are symbols of excellence, so they must be handsome, well-grounded, educated, well-dressed, politically oriented, personable, and articulate. But according to Don, they aren't required to have his same level of killer instinct, or his need to develop successful new ideas for the marketplace. At one time, he had a very different view about the corporate environment. I grew up in a blue-collar background, graduated with a degree in applied physics. I went to work for a big company. Always dreamed of going up the corporate ladder and being some high executive. Executives in corporate structures just didn't live up to what I thought they would. I put them on a pedestal. I got really discouraged being around them and the things they did. So I started my own company. I was 29 years old. Don learned how businesses operate from his corporate experiences. But the most important thing he learned was that a vocation in the corporate world would never light his emotional fire. This knowledge helped him to find the vocation where his talents and aptitudes would be best suited. Without his corporate experience, Don might never have decided to go out on his own. A generic author? A member of my audience recently asked me, "What about your vocation? You emphasize the importance of specialization and that choice of vocation is a critical element in accounting for variations in wealth. But you yourself are in a very competitive vocation. Are you guilty of not practicing what you are preaching?" No, I'm innocent, but let me prove my point. I estimate that there are several hundred thousand authors in America. If I had to compete directly with each of them, I'd go out of business in short order. I am not a generic author. My vocation is not ever listed as writer. In fact, I am a specialist within the large population of authors and writers. I write about how common people become wealthy in one generation. I write about topics that others overlook. I am the Mr. Richard of literature. Even Webster's defines vocation as the special function of an individual or group. It may be easy to say this now since I've already written a bestseller. Hindsight is always 20/20, but I never doubted that The Millionaire Next Door would be a hit. I planned this work for many years. I tested my ideas in hundreds of seminars across America. I knew that two major concepts turned on the attendees. First, I defined who the American millionaire was and was not. Second, I described how common people become millionaires in one generation. For several years within the past 7, I received requests to do more than 200 seminars and speeches on these two topics. Why all this interest? It was because I had information that no one else possessed. Not just information, but survey-based insights into how to become financially independent. The responses from my audiences and the insights millionaires gave me refined my job description. My work provides answers to questions asked by many people. And when it comes to competitors, I am like Mr. Richards' listing in the telephone book. One of the millionaires featured in Money Magazine's cover story on The Millionaire Next Door said it best. Mr. John Shmilgenko is a real estate investor. He was asked about the source of his wisdom about becoming wealthy. He said, "Playing Monopoly as a kid, I bought properties because they were cheap. I took a similar approach in real life." It was the millionaire respondents who encouraged me to specialize, to monopolize. I would never have succeeded as a writer of love stories, mysteries, or any other type of generic fiction. Some of my relatives remind me that the Stanley ancestry is filled with writers and poets dating back to ancient Ireland. They think success is a genetic factor. But I don't think that the quality of the writing explains the demand for The Millionaire Next Door. Where were all these ancestors' genes when I was getting straight C's in high school and college English and writing courses? The big issue is what is said, not how it is said. The market I selected defines what I do. I know from thousands of contact hours with the public what it is they want. I know the questions they want answered. With this knowledge in hand, I always felt confident about the demand for my work. You don't need to be Shakespeare if you have excellent market research. The basic premise of my vocation is giving the market what it wants and is not currently receiving from other authors. It's that simple. I do feel just a bit guilty about the success of my bestseller. There must be thousands of A students who never made it onto the New York Times bestseller list, let alone stayed there for more than 100 weeks. On the other hand, most of these writers repeatedly ignore rule number one in marketing. Me, me, me is dull, dull, dull. It's the A student who more often than not writes beautifully and states concepts with great elegance. His works are grammatically sound, but his criteria for selecting a theme is strictly me, me, me. He writes about things that are of interest to him and forgets about the interests of the market. So what if you write beautifully but your main theme is strictly Dullsville? Or what if there are so many competitors in your subject area that you cannot even get a publisher to take a second look at your manuscript? I have the best of both worlds. I have great interest in my main topic area, and the market demand is strong for my work. But I must admit that my first love was American history. Long ago, however, I realized that the level of competition in this area is extremely high. What if I attempted to publish in the arena of American history? I would be living proof that me, me, me is dull, dull, dull. Of course, I can offset my guilt about being successful by reminding myself about my investment in time, energy, and money. I have a few million frequent flyer miles. That's the number it takes to visit millionaires who want to tell their success story. That's the requirement for addressing hundreds of audiences and asking for advice and suggestions. So, in many ways, the ideas in The Millionaire Next Door and The Millionaire Mind are the product of my personal, hands-on market research, the type that few writers ever have a chance to conduct. Occasionally, I've had the chance to advise other writers about theme selection and other marketing issues. However, most believe that what I'm suggesting is blasphemy. I recently attended a book fair with more than 20 other published authors, some of whom at one time or another taught creative writing, and several were professors of English. I really felt way out of place. But I said to myself, "Tom, every one of these people can write, that is, state concepts, better than you. But not one of them ever had a book on the bestseller list." Several of the authors who taught creative writing clustered together in a corner. They spoke of style, creativity, and the burden of grading 130 papers this term. One of them told me that he really had little time to contemplate, to give deep thought to the theme of his next work. But he will have to come up with something soon. It's still publish or perish in his business. The best part of his energy resources are given to commuting, faculty meetings, teaching, and grading papers. What energy remains is allocated to his next book. I strongly believe that it's nearly impossible to write effectively if the book is relegated to a third or fourth priority. Some of these insights originated in the School of Hard Knocks. Others were gathered from reading about productive people. In fact, for many years I looked for a template of productivity that I could follow. I never found it. Much has been written about the productivity of groups and businesses, but writing is an individual event. It's different from corporate sports. Even many of the biographies of great team leaders and economically productive business people do not apply to my vocation. Choice of spouse. Can you live forever? Marry the wrong spouse, and every day will feel like an eternity. Marry the right spouse, and life will be a joyful and perhaps even a rich experience. A rocky road. Several booking agents have told me there are 5 top-rated conventions held annually in this country, and an invitation to be a main platform presenter at any of them indicates genuine superstar status on the lecture circuit. That made me somewhat nervous when I was invited to speak at one of those conventions, the Million Dollar Round Table, a trade association composed of the world's top-producing life insurance agents. At the time, I was a college professor from Georgia State University, but the head of the speaker selection committee read about me in the Wall Street Journal and liked the idea of having an expert on millionaires address his colleagues. I've never thought of myself in the superstar category, but there I was in front of 14,000 people, along with distinguished speakers like Eunice Shriver, Marvin Hamlisch, and Lee Iacocca. Another speaker on the platform that day was a former football player who had an outstanding professional career and had played in 4 Super Bowls, in spite of being wounded in the Vietnam War. This player was a delightful, down-to-earth man who had made a successful transition from pro football to celebrity speaker status. Every important group wanted to hear him because he was an excellent speaker. He could write his own ticket, demand considerable fees, and be very selective in his choice of clients. Few men can play ball at that level and then become a star in a completely different field, so I suspected he was unusually talented and would surely become an economic success for the rest of his adult life. Surprisingly, I never heard anything about this player again until our local newspaper, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, published a story stating that this player, now bankrupt, was hawking his Super Bowl rings. How could it be that a fellow with considerable talent for earning a high income turns up as the subject of a newspaper story detailing his bankruptcy? There it was in black and white. The player, who overcame Vietnam War wounds to play in 4 Super Bowls, filed for Chapter 7 bankruptcy, 2 days after selling his championship rings to help pay back federal taxes. The article went on to say, his former wife said in a countersuit that he just wants to avoid paying her $837,948 from the sale of their home. In the bankruptcy petition he filed, the player stated that he had already paid his ex-wife $1.3 million in cash and property. Could it be that his economic reversals were related to his divorce? Divorce generally has a devastating impact on an individual's net worth, and that's true for both millionaires and non-millionaires. Since 92% of the millionaire households in America are composed of a married couple, and these millionaire couples have less than one-third the divorce rate of non-millionaire couples, we can conclude that here is another factor that distinguishes the millionaire mind: the ability to choose the right mate for life. Being divorced doesn't exclude one from becoming and remaining a millionaire. It just makes it significantly more difficult, as this player may have discovered. The economic productivity of marriage. Studies have consistently found a significant correlation between length of marriage and wealth accumulation. One study of over 12,000 respondents, Does Marital History Matter? The Effect of Marital Status on Wealth Outcomes Among Pre-Retirement Age Adults, by Janet Wilmoth and Gregor Koso, is particularly illuminating. The authors found that consistent participation in marriage results in significantly higher wealth. Conversely, those people who are not married continuously over time have a propensity to accumulate lower levels of wealth during their adult life cycle. What is it about marital status that affects one's level of wealth? According to the research conducted by Wilmoth and Koso, legal marriages have certain institutionalized features that are conducive to accumulating wealth, an important one being the division of labor within the marital relationship. Also, certain economies of scale are present in a married couple household that are not normally associated with a single-person household. The positive correlation between length of marriage and level of wealth is very strong and holds true throughout all education and income groups in America. Millionaires and marriage. What would happen today if all the millionaire couples in America immediately broke up? Of course, there would be a lot more singles heading up millionaire households. There would also be one-third fewer millionaire households, because their assets have to be divided. Domestic overhead would double, and legal fees would take a nice share. But like the rest of the population, millionaires stay married because of reasons other than economics. Millionaires, and those who will probably attain this status, have a unique ability to select mates with a certain set of qualities. Some of these qualities are significant in explaining their long-term happy marriages, while other traits are more directly related to wealth accumulation. People who stay married for the full term, till death do us part, tend to be unselfish, caring, forgiving, patient, understanding, disciplined, and virtuous. It also helps if the couple has similar interests, activities, and opinions. Like Tina Turner, you may ask, what's love got to do with it? Underlying any happy marriage are love and deep affection. But affection can cloud one's judgment. If you are deeply in love with a potential spouse who lacks traits like patience and understanding, you may give him or her grades that are too high because of your emotional involvement. Only later, through direct experience prior to your divorce, are you able to recognize your spouse's shortcomings. The millionaires I have interviewed seem to have early warning systems. They have the uncanny ability to determine if a prospective spouse is unselfish, caring, and virtuous before they become emotionally involved, and that accounts for the high frequency of full-term marriages in this group. Ask the prototypical millionaire who has been married to the same spouse 25, 35, or even 50 years, what can you tell me about your spouse? Among the first things they say include down-to-earth, unselfish, has traditional values, my emotional backbone, patient, understanding. There is an even more revealing question. What was it that initially attracted you to your spouse? Respondents will, more often than not, mention some physical attribute. But physical attractiveness is never the only factor. Most suggest that they had some intuition about other qualities, such as those listed above, that their prospective spouse possessed. Consider the case of Barbara, Bobby, and Forrester, who have been married for more than 35 years. They have four grown children, and they own and operate three manufacturing companies. They are economically successful. Bobby was raised in a small western Kansas town near the Colorado border. Forrester grew up on a farm in southern Georgia. How did a girl from western Kansas ever meet a farm boy from southern Georgia at a college mixer in Boston? Both Bobby and Forrester came from modest backgrounds, but both were extremely bright and excelled in high school. Their families sacrificed to put together a college fund for their children, and both received additional support from academic scholarships. Forrester attended MIT. Bobby went to Wellesley. According to Forrester, the first thing I noticed was that her clothes were handmade. They were well-made, but homemade. From the very beginning, Forrester was fascinated with Bobby. Certainly she was cute and charming, but it was her wardrobe that impressed him most. Her mother had made her clothes. This fact told him a lot about Bobby's background. It was obvious that she came from a family of modest means, but nevertheless they had sent their daughter to one of the top women's colleges in America. He reasoned that both Bobby and her parents had their priorities ranked in the proper order. Bobby was impressed with Forrester's presence at MIT, given his modest background as a farm boy. They both had a sensitivity about their choice of an ideal spouse, and their choice has tested true for over 35 years. Bobby and Forrester were suited for each other, and they were also ideally suited to own and operate a family business. Early in their marriage, they made trade-offs between buying expensive consumer goods and funding a business. The business was their first priority. It's no wonder they are also financially successful today. No one ever became wealthy by spending the household's money on expensive consumer artifacts, like clothes and new cars. No one ever became a millionaire by using consumer goods as status symbols while neglecting their investments in private business or publicly traded stocks. Both Bobby and Forrester learned these realities from their frugal parents. Marriage vows and the secret of washing cars. Common interests. Couples who share common interests tend to remain married, and there is a correlation between length of marriage and net worth. But the sharing of common interests and duration of a marriage are nowhere near perfect predications of wealth accumulation. If a couple has a common interest in spending all their income, they may shop together and stay married for a long time, but it's unlikely they'll ever become financially independent. So it's the types of activities and interests that a couple shares that are key. Shared interests that are related to accumulating wealth are important, including preparing a household budget, planning and making investments, setting financial goals, and owning and operating a business. Couples who share these interests are much more likely to attain millionaire status. To them, it seems a lot more sensible to purchase an expensive new car out of gains made from wise investments than from earned income. I recently bumped into an old acquaintance who told me he had just bought a boat for $23,000. He also made it clear that the purchase was funded from part of the dividends paid on just one of his investments in a public corporation. He and his wife of 12 years both enjoy boating, and they also enjoy working together on the family budget, studying investment opportunities, and planning long-term financial goals. For this couple, boating is especially enjoyable because it's not a substitute to building wealth. In fact, the boat was a reward. They rewarded each other for exceeding their goal of accumulating wealth. They purchased their boat with just a minor portion of the gains they realized from a stock purchased nearly 10 years ago. Beside the money they invested, the couple allocated a few hours of time to studying Value Line's assessment of stocks, where they discovered this particular one. They didn't even have to purchase this fine publication. They found it off the shelf in the local library. Having a common interest in wealth-building activities is a key for couples who wish to become financially independent. And the most common of these activities is owning and operating a family business, like B&D Ferguson. Neither Mr. or Mrs. Ferguson ever attended college, but their household's net worth exceeds that of most college graduates. Both were ambitious and hardworking, and had a keen interest in becoming financially independent so they could retire earlier than most couples. They reasoned that business ownership would provide them with the highest probability of achieving their goal. The couple was very careful in determining the ideal type of business. They searched for a category that had a high profit potential and found one they thought people would never recognize as generating high earnings. In their selected trade area, it had few competitors. Mrs. Ferguson told me, "Thank you for not including the car wash industry as one of the businesses of self-made millionaires. The less public attention, the better. The reality is that there are many self-made millionaires in this industry." People often ask me about the size of the investment required to start a business. The common belief is that it's always very costly. People think it takes millions to make millions. But the Fergusons had a different view. You don't necessarily need to invest millions to become economically independent if you start out with a small, efficient operation. According to Mrs. Ferguson, "At the age of 26 and 29 respectively, my husband and I leased a run-down, full-service car wash with $5,000 we borrowed from my husband's parents." $5,000 put the couple in the car wash business. It was a wise investment. 13 years later, they sold the business for $750,000. Yes, the Fergusons had found a diamond in the rough. Most other married couples wouldn't have purchased a run-down car wash. But it never bothered the Fergusons that their business wasn't glamorous and didn't denote high status or wealth. The Fergusons were never concerned that most of their customers viewed them as strictly blue-collar. Their beliefs were part of the couple's strength. Anytime one of them questioned their career decision to wash cars, it was countered with arguments like this. Most car wash owners, including my husband and me, are probably better off than our college-educated professional customers. The sacrifices are definitely worth it long-term. The couple actually turned the potential disadvantage of not attending college into an advantage. They motivated themselves into being frugal and productive by constantly reminding themselves that they had accumulated more wealth than most of their well-educated, well-dressed, upscale customers. Even during hard times when it rained for several days and they had no customers, they thought of the long-term, not minor, setbacks. Long-term, we will retire with more. One in a million. Attraction and successful choices. One issue is very clear. Income and wealth are not the most important factors that account for a millionaire's successful marriage. Nor were either of these the primary factor in the initial interest they discovered for the man or woman they ultimately married. Why all this interest in what millionaires think makes up a successful marriage? The typical millionaire couple in America has been married for 28 years. One in four have been married for 38 or more years. Considering the divorce rate in contemporary America, millionaires as a group can teach us all something about finding the right mate for life. Also, choice of spouse is a major factor in explaining variations in wealth. There is a highly significant negative correlation between divorce and wealth. And conversely, there is a highly significant relationship between years of uninterrupted marriage and net worth. In essence, why are millionaires millionaires? Because they made the right decisions concerning several major issues in their life, and one of these is choice of spouse. So it's not surprising that their spouse's physical attraction wasn't considered to be very important in a millionaire's successful marriage. In my personal and group interviews, physically attractive was mentioned by nearly all respondents, and it does make some contribution to successful marriages. However, the importance of this quality by itself is grossly overstated in the current literature. As one of my respondents said about physical attractiveness, "Given the choice, I prefer to be physically attracted to a woman who is intelligent, honest, unselfish, well-adjusted." In a nutshell, that's what most millionaires tell me about the physically attractive quality. They almost never even consider marrying someone merely for physically attractive reasons. Intelligence is important as a choice criterion in the millionaire group, but other very important qualities must also be present. Future millionaires seem to be able to judge potential partners with respect to traits like sincerity, cheerfulness, reliability, and affection. How and where do millionaires acquire this ability to distinguish an ideal spouse from other candidates? You will recall the earlier discussion, school days. What was one of the most important aspects of school and college that influenced millionaires in becoming economically productive adults? Learning how to make accurate judgments about people. In this regard, 88% indicated that their school and college experiences had a significant degree of influence on them. This dimension was second in importance only to developing a strong work ethic. Most millionaires said that school and college-related experiences taught them to be sensitive to variations in the qualities of people. The more interaction they had with a variety of fellow students in many different social environments, the better they were able to make accurate judgments about candidates for the role of life partner. Is this person truly sincere, reliable, and so forth? That's the question that is a critical part of the spouse selection process. Parents, have you encouraged your children to be sensitive to variations in sincerity among their boyfriends and girlfriends? The key issue here is how sincere their friends are with all people, not just those they are trying to impress. How do they treat people? Are they sincere because of their nature and upbringing? Or are they able to turn sincere only when it benefits them? Not all of the intelligent people one meets in college have all the other important qualities. In fact, the quality of high intelligence can often act as camouflage. Some people are so taken with a suitor's high level of intellect that the suitor's deficiencies are concealed or overlooked, just as others are blinded by physical attractiveness. If one places too much emphasis on a quality like intelligence, then he may be insensitive to variations in sincerity, cheerfulness, reliability, and virtue, for example. Important qualities. Why is it that most millionaire couples stay married? Both husbands and wives have strong views about the factors that contribute to a successful marriage. They know what the components of a lasting marriage are, and they have no difficulty describing them. A successful marriage is a direct function of the presence of several qualities. Both husbands and wives have almost identical views about these qualities in their spouses. Nearly all of the males, 99%, and the large majority of females, 94%, indicated that being honest is important. Both groups are also quite similar in the frequency with which they rate four other qualities as important. 96% of the males and 92% of the females believe that their mates are responsible. The same percentage, 95% of both husbands and wives, view their respective spouses as being loving. The large majority of both groups also believe that their spouses are capable and supportive. All of these qualities are important components of a long and successful marriage. These views provide much food for thought. The typical millionaire couple has been together for nearly 30 years, and their bond tends to be permanent as well as economically productive. And no matter if you ask the husband or the wife to explain their household's productivity, the answer is the same. Each gives substantial credit to the other. For every 100 millionaires who say that having a supportive spouse was not important in explaining their economic success, there are 1,317 who indicate their spouse was important. Of the 100 who did not give credit to their spouse, 22 were never married, and 23 were either divorced or separated. That leaves only 55 in 1,317 who believed that their spouse did not play an important role in their economic success. Mr. S., an entrepreneur, spoke of his success in a focus group interview. He made it abundantly clear to the group that his family's business would never have been so productive without the support of his wife of 38 years. "I'll hand it to my wife. If it hadn't been for her, we couldn't do what we've done up to this point. We had 5 children. I never had to go to the doctor with her or with one of the children. She managed all of that. She did it all." A large majority of millionaires concur with Mr. S.'s views. Each has his or her individual story, but they all have common features. They all state that his or her spouse is very supportive, and that in order for one's mate to be supportive, he or she must be honest, responsible, loving, and capable. These are the basic components of successful marriages among millionaires. Mr. Don D., a self-made multimillionaire entrepreneur, provided me with an excellent profile of a supportive, responsible, and capable spouse. When Don was 29, he asked his wife about her views on his starting his own business. He explained that certain sacrifices would have to be made. First, he would have to leave his well-paying corporate position. Don asked her opinion about financing the startup of a business. "What if we have to sell everything?" My wife said, "What happens if you don't make money?" I said, "Well, I'll get another job." And she said, "Fine." But 2 years after Don started the business, the venture didn't make it. His wife, who worked with him, never once complained. Don then returned to corporate life. 5 years later, he quit his corporate job, with his wife's blessing and encouragement again. Don started another business, which has been a success since its founding in 1976. Since then, he has also started 3 other businesses. How does Don define capable and responsible? His wife not only took responsibility for almost all the domestic tasks, she also did much more. She never had Don's technical expertise in physics, but she took the initiative and learned about the business and its technology. Today, Don says with pride and admiration, that 2 of the 4 businesses that he started are owned and very efficiently managed by his wife. "I've been married 30 years. My wife hasn't changed. Just the same person today. I could never imagine it without my wife. I'm sort of headstrong. She's a quiet, calming type of person." Don indicated that he and his wife are the perfect match. Both recognize and admire each other's qualities, and both possess many of the 5 major qualities essential for a productive and lasting relationship. They are mutually honest, responsible, loving, capable, and supportive.
Beyond physical attractiveness, there are also five major qualities that account for millionaires first becoming interested in their spouses. Again, Don is like most millionaires, who will tell you that they are drawn to their mate because he or she was intelligent, sincere, cheerful, reliable, and affectionate. How accurate were these perceptions developed during the early stages of courtship? Nearly all of the millionaires say that intelligence is an important quality. I once asked a group of 10 millionaires to describe their wives, and the word intelligent was frequently mentioned. But what did these men mean when they referred to their spouses as intelligent? My wife has the ability to learn and adjust to anything. Right now, she could run the business better than I can. 90% of the husbands and 85% of the wives in the millionaire household graduated from college. The wives, in particular, did well. About 80% ranked in the top quarter of the class. Of course, there are other ways to measure intelligence, but no matter how you define it, millionaires feel that their spouses have a lot of it. What about the other factors? 95% of both husbands and wives became interested in their future spouses because they were sincere, and it seems most were good judges. According to these respondents, sincerity is a precursor to honesty, which is very important in ultimately contributing to a successful marriage. Most millionaire respondents have had nearly 30 years to judge the accuracy of their early evaluation of their mates. They probably have a firm understanding of their spouse's qualities. Those future spouses who were judged to be reliable early in the courtship proved to be more than just reliable. They were also responsible. Reliability is a precursor of responsibility, another marital success factor. The money factor. What role does high income earning potential play in attracting a spouse and contributing to a successful marriage? Husbands and wives within the ranks of millionaires have different views about the wealth and income qualities of their mates. Women are 4 times more likely than men to indicate that the high income earner quality of their spouse was important in accounting for a successful marriage. Nearly 1/2 of the wives, 49%, indicated that high income was important. In sharp contrast, only 12% of the husbands indicated that their spouse's earnings were significant in contributing to their successful marriages. As I have so often stated, income is not wealth, and it is often said that money income can't buy happiness. Although the wealthy quality was not rated as significant by the majority of millionaire husbands and wives, the wives were 3 times more likely, 37%, than husbands, 12%, to believe that wealthy was a key success factor. This doesn't necessarily mean that a majority of America's millionaire couples would remain successfully married if they were broke. What these husbands and wives are telling us about their wealth and marriage is that they could be just as successfully married with much less income and with a fraction of their wealth. Most of these husbands and wives are more sensitive to variations in qualities other than wealth and income. Millionaires, both men and women, tell me over and over again about their mates. He or she is honest, responsible, loving, capable, and supportive. These qualities are most important in explaining their successful marriages, and most millionaire husbands and wives have not and will not substitute wealth or income for these 5 basic elements. Women are more sensitive to income and wealth qualities of their mates for good reason. Most wives in millionaire households have traditional values and feel that the man of the house should be the main income generator. The men share this view. Few millionaire husbands, about only 1 in 8, feel otherwise. These survey results are congruent with the views espoused by John Gray, a leading authority on the differences between men and women with regard to motives, habits, and drives. According to Gray's article, Mars and Venus, Do Men Buy Love? Are Women Needy? Men have a biological need to provide for women. In fact, man's primary need is to be needed by a woman. A large part of this need is in the context of income and wealth. Here again, Gray's views are supported by my survey research on millionaires. Do women actually search for men who have high income-producing capabilities? Gray believes they do. But the men are different. Not only do they want to provide economically for women, they are also likely to be turned off by women who are generating or have the potential to generate high incomes on their own. Here is some of the data that illustrates these major differences between men and women in the millionaire household. A significantly greater percentage of wives, 59%, as opposed to husbands, 13%, indicated that the high income earning potential quality was important in initially interesting them in their spouse. What about the other economic factor? The wealthy quality was not as critical for the majority of either wives, 23%, or husbands, 9%. But women do outpace men in this regard. Interestingly, the ambitious quality was more important to a higher percentage of both women, 82%, and men, 48%, than the wealthy quality. Self-disciplined and secure are also more important for women. Men are more likely to become interested in women if they are well-dressed, 80% versus 60%, virtuous, 79% versus 61%, cheerful, 93% versus 83%, and encouraging, 87% versus 80%. Women who marry men who become millionaires are attracted to those who have more than the five big attractive qualities: intelligent, sincere, cheerful, reliable, and affectionate. They must also be ambitious and have high income earning potential. For nearly 4 in 5 women, wealthy before marriage was not an important quality. Of course, these women married men who eventually became millionaires along with their wives. Men have the same 5 big qualities in mind when initially evaluating potential spouses, but many do not want to compete with their spouse in terms of money, income, or wealth. They do want their spouse to be intelligent, but only a minority became interested because of such qualities as income potential or ambitious. More often than not, the wives allow their husbands to take the role of main breadwinner for the family. The criteria for choice. How did millionaires determine beforehand that a potential spouse would eventually turn out to be the ideal husband or wife? First, the criteria they use to evaluate potential mates are the same ones that produce long-term successful marriages. Second, they are able to accurately predict whether a potential spouse will rate high on these criteria. The large majority of millionaires made such predictions and corresponding selections long before they became millionaires. Why is it that so many adults in our population are unable to make the same kind of accurate predictions about a potential spouse? Making accurate predictions is actually a two-step process. First, you must identify the right criteria that are compatible with a long-term marriage. If the criteria are wrong, then it doesn't matter if you can accurately predict them in your prospective mate. What criteria do most people, non-millionaires, non-potential millionaires, use when selecting a mate? How are these different from what you have already read about millionaires in this chapter? Dr. Belinda Tucker of UCLA recently conducted a major study of 3,407 adults from the general population, ranging in age between 18 and 55, on the criteria adults use in selecting mates. She presented her findings at the 1997 National Conference of the American Psychological Association. Professor Tucker found that men give more weight to the physical attractiveness dimension than to any other criteria. Men rated the income criterion, salary and earning potential, as second only in importance to attractiveness. Contrast these findings with what has been reported about millionaire men. They say that the factors that contributed to their successful marriages are honest, responsible, loving, capable, and supportive. So if you marry an attractive, high-income earning woman who is not honest, responsible, loving, capable, and supportive, your marriage may not succeed. Dr. Tucker's study also determined the criteria that are most important in mate selection for women. The salary and earning potential dimension was rated highest, more important than attractiveness, education, or occupation. Again, this is in sharp contrast to the mate selection criteria used by women who are millionaires. Most of these women indicated that honesty, intelligence, and ambition are more fundamental to a lasting marriage than the income or earning potential of their mates. Contrasting millionaires with the general population does shed some light on why the divorce rate is so high among the non-millionaires. Dr. Tucker stated that satisfaction with your partner's financial contributions is strongly related to how you feel about your relationship and whether you feel you will stay in the relationship. Dr. Tucker also found that overall, both men and women would contemplate divorcing a spouse who lost his or her job. This attitude is diametrically opposed to the attitudes of couples who are or are likely to become millionaires. Remember, to build wealth, one may likely have to forego realizing a high income for many years. It's not unusual for wealth-building couples to realize just enough to live on while investing every spare dollar. Nor is it unusual for self-made millionaires to report that, "Just after I was fired from my job, I started our business, spent every bit of our savings. My spouse's income kept us alive for the first few but long, long years." Another woman, with her husband, the co-founder and owner of a family business, stated that, "No longer will I feel apologetic for being so frugal. We are not cheap, only true entrepreneurs. We resist the urges to fall into the traps of our high-consuming neighbors, who make more yearly income than we do. But we will retire with more wealth." Dr. Tucker's data would suggest that in today's world, this woman is unusual. She never thought of breaking her wedding vows because of income-related issues, and that's one reason she and her husband are wealthy today. They toughed it out in good times and bad, and through many years of having a small income. They would never have become millionaires if income had been the main thing that held them together. They both had the same set of attitudes, beliefs, and values, and both believed that attaining financial independence was worth making short-term sacrifices. Dr. Tucker found that men in general ranked the physical attractiveness dimension above all other mate selection criteria. Whatever happened to the belief that beauty is only skin deep? To most millionaires and those who are on track to becoming wealthy, attractiveness is only one of many qualities, and not the most highly rated. Perhaps our high divorce rate is related to the importance many men place on attractiveness. A woman might be attractive at the time of her wedding, but if she doesn't stay that way, he may have grounds, in his own mind, for divorce. This is the reality of too many weak marriages in America. According to Dr. Tucker's findings, there may be an even higher rate of husband-inspired divorces when a woman loses both her attractiveness and her income-producing job at about the same time. In this event, the wife may actually be blessed that she'll be divorced from a loser of a husband. He's not likely to become wealthy or even content because he has a history, a habit of entering into unstable marriages. Divorces take a great toll on one's net worth and happiness. A case of stability and compatibility. Victor Gantz and his wife Sally were married for 50 years. They were a low-key Manhattan couple who spent much of their spare time studying and investing in art. A New York Times article by Akril Vogel, "Prized Picasso Leads Collection to Record $206 Million Auction," states, "They had a passion and a commitment to collecting art, spending every Saturday touring art galleries. Often they would sacrifice things like a new winter coat whenever they couldn't resist making a purchase." The Gantz's art collection recently sold at a Christie's auction for $206 million. One of the paintings, Picasso's The Dream, was originally purchased by Mr. Gantz in 1941 for only $7,000. At the auction, it sold for $48.2 million. The Gantz's not only had a full-term marriage, they also had an economically productive one. It was not based on attractiveness and income, but on much more. They shared a common interest in art. They both were willing to forego the purchase of consumer goods and instead invested in high-quality art. The Gantz's were a cheap date, spending their Saturdays walking through art galleries. These galleries usually charged no admission fees. EOC inoculation. A self-made decamillionaire telephoned me about a week after my article, "Why You're Not as Wealthy as You Should Be," was published in Medical Economics. He told me he'd read the article three times, and he repeatedly quoted material from it. "Wealth is more often the result of hard work, perseverance, and most of all, self-discipline." He was especially taken by the fact that most American millionaires are self-made and that they are frugal. During our discussion, I also emphasized that most millionaires receive zero cash gifts or other economic outpatient care, EOC, from their relatives. He was particularly interested to learn that there is an inverse relationship between EOC and the level of wealth of recipients. As soon as I spoke those words, he interrupted me, "I have to have reprints of your articles. Can you send me some?" He wanted to share my articles with three young men. It seems that this decamillionaire had three daughters, one in law school, one recently graduated from a top undergraduate university, the youngest in her senior year of college. All three had steady boyfriends, and in his estimation, these three young men needed to be enlightened. The decamillionaire felt certain they were all well aware that he was wealthy, and he also believed that these young men might be wealth-oriented, W-O, or inclined to become interested in a prospective spouse because his or her family is wealthy. Further, he felt that these suitors might believe that the road to wealth begins and ends with OPM, other people's money. This decamillionaire felt compelled to do something to enhance his daughter's spousal selection process, and that's where the reprints of my articles came into the picture. How could he test whether or not his daughter's suitors were interested in his wealth? He gave each of them reprints of several of my articles discussing the importance of hard work, discipline, and a frugal lifestyle, and highlighting the detrimental effects of EOC. This, he made very clear to me, was a nice way of telling them, no EOC. Yes, it's a nice way of telling three young suitors that they will be receiving zero economic outpatient care. If a suitor suddenly lost interest in his daughter, he could assume that the fellow was just W.O. What are the odds that the three suitors will suddenly lose interest in their respective girlfriends? According to my own data, it's unlikely. Only about 9 in 100 married male millionaires initially became interested in their spouses because their parents were wealthy, and even those 9 indicated that other qualities were important. In fact, none of these people became interested in their mates because of the wealthy quality alone. At least 8 out of 10 were attracted because their future spouse was sincere, down-to-earth, intelligent, affectionate, reliable, accepting, wise, cheerful, and secure. Wealth-oriented women. What about women who were attracted to their mates because of the wealthy quality? Wives in the millionaire couple household are more likely than husbands to indicate that the wealthy quality in a spouse was important. About 23 in 100 wives, as opposed to 9 out of 100 husbands, stated that they were initially interested in their mates because of wealthy, about 2.5 times more women than men. It's the perceived wealth of a potential mate's parents that is key. Are all those women your son has dated just interested in his mother and father's treasure chest? The data suggests not. Even those women who indicated that wealthy was an attraction felt that many more qualities were significant. More than 90% were also attracted to a prospective spouse who was sincere, intelligent, affectionate, reliable, accepting, wise, cheerful, secure, and had high income earning potential. Also, 85% of these women were attracted because of the ambitious quality. This is refreshing news. Overall, most men and women who marry and become millionaires don't care how much money their in-laws may have accumulated. They are indeed wise. It's much better to marry based upon qualities and traits that are person-specific rather than ancestor or parent-specific. The large majority of millionaires have told me that the economic qualities of their in-laws had little to do with their choice of spouse. And it's a good thing because oftentimes one is better able to predict the qualities of a spouse than the behaviors of in-laws. There is a simple rule about becoming wealthy in America. Never consider relying on other people's money to make you rich. Those who ignore this rule can be in for surprises, as this case study illustrates. Peggy is from a working-class background. She earned an undergraduate degree from a major university. She was charming and very attractive. Her parents were impressed with people who were rich, and they taught Peggy to feel the same way. However, both Peggy and her blue-collar parents assumed that people who have high occupational status have high levels of wealth. Thus, anyone who is a physician, attorney, accountant, or corporate officer is wealthy. Unfortunately, Peggy violated this rule of wealth-oriented people. Lesson number 1. If you are inclined to marry the son or daughter of a wealthy family, first make certain that it is, in fact, wealthy. The appearances of wealth can be deceiving. Her selected spouse came from a prominent family and was a direct descendant of important people. His father was a well-known business leader in the community, and both parents were active in a variety of civic and other noble causes. They lived in a large home and drove luxury motor vehicles. They were members of a prestigious country club. His sister was a member of the Junior League. But as Shakespeare said, all that glitters is not gold. Unfortunately, Peggy was unable to distinguish gold from iron pyrite, or fool's gold. She became initially interested and ultimately married a young man because of the wealthy quality. But none of the facts cited above are perfect predictors of variations in wealth. It was only after she married that Peggy discovered the truth. Her spouse's family had been in financial difficulty for years, even before the wedding. They had done a lot to keep up the face of a successful and prosperous family. Peggy thought that she and her husband would be given a home, but no EOC in cash or equivalents was ever distributed. Even more unpleasant was the ultimate cold turkey realization. Her husband told her she would have to go to work. Peggy's marriage didn't last 3 years. Still, she was determined to meet and ultimately marry a wealthy man, and that's when her past experience and intuition kicked in. Searching for a convoy, Peggy accepted a position at a large trust company. She met and married an affluent client of this trust company, a man many years her senior. This time she made the right choice. She hit pay dirt, a multimillionaire. At present, he works, she does not. She spends, he builds wealth. It's a balancing act. Will his financial balance sheet accommodate Peggy's hyper-consumption lifestyle? We'll see. Lesson number 2. Even if your in-laws are very wealthy, you or your spouse may never receive a dollar's worth of inheritance or even EOC. Not all wealthy parents provide their sons and daughters households with EOC. Some do not even leave an inheritance to them. In fact, 46% of people in such situations never receive an intergenerational transfer of wealth. About 1 in 3 women who married men from wealthy families report that their household received an average of about $400,000 from their spouse's relatives. This translates into about $13,333 per year of marriage. When I first revealed this dollar amount to a group of my associates, one especially insightful character remarked, "She'd be better off financially working 30 years at McDonald's." You may not agree with this statement, but it's hard to disagree with the facts. Most people who marry for OPM are surprised. In some cases, the target's family only looked wealthy. In others, the family of the targeted spouse doesn't believe in providing EOC to their sons or daughters, in-laws, and others. Many wealthy parents believe that EOC dampens ambition. Wealth-oriented men. What about men who are WO? They are more productive in their quest for OPM than are the women. But for every 100 WO men, there are about 255 WO women. Only about 1 in 3 WO men report that their household received $0 of EOC or inheritance. The large majority of WO men report that about $700,000 in intergenerational transfers benefited their households. Why do WO males often benefit more from EOC than women who are WO? The answer is actually part of lesson number 3. Lesson number 3. About one half of the women who marry WO men become housewives. Daughters of wealthy parents who are housewives are among the most likely to receive EOC. Conversely, most WO women marry men who are economically productive. Wealthy parents give the fewest number of dollars of EOC to their most productive offspring. If a WO person marries a productive mate, the more the productive person earns, the less likely he or she will receive EOC. So the choice is clear. It seems to be true that one can marry wealth or income, not wealth and income. Lesson number 4. Wealthy parents prefer providing EOC to their grandchildren than to WO sons-in-law and daughters-in-law. If you marry an offspring of a wealthy couple, it's better emotionally and spiritually to assume that none of this wealth will ever come your way. For the large majority of millionaire couples, more than 80%, other people's wealth was never an important factor in their choice of spouse. Nor was it ever important in explaining a long-term successful marriage. Love versus honesty. I once asked Henry, a self-made millionaire, if he ever thought that he and his steady girlfriend Sally would be married someday. He answered with a firm yes. But after 7 years of dating, he broke off the relationship. Oh yes, Henry loved Sally and she loved him. Everything seemed to be a proper fit. The couple had much in common. They enjoyed the same lifestyle elements. Their opinions and interests were in harmony. They liked the same foods and beverages. Both enjoyed clothes shopping. Then, several years into the relationship, something happened. Henry discovered that the love of his life had deliberately hidden more than $35,000 of outstanding debt. Even more significant, she was in default on more than $20,000 in loans. The balance of the outstanding debt was a combination of credit card balances, auto loans, and store credit accounts. All her outstanding loans were in arrears. One of Sally's creditors contacted Henry because he was listed as a credit reference on a loan application. He received a letter from the lender who was apparently having a problem locating Sally. She had changed addresses several times since the loan was made, and she was well aware that she had violated her loan agreement. Sally had never paid back a penny of her student loans, even though she had completed her undergraduate and graduate education years ago. The lender who contacted Henry was not the only one trying to track down Sally. Several others were also in pursuit of what was owed them. Given these facts, Henry was shocked. Sally had never given him any indication that she had credit problems. In fact, she gave signs that she was well off financially. She had a well-paying job, a new automobile, lovely clothes. Henry confronted Sally with the evidence of her financial crisis. At first, she said that it wasn't a problem. She told him that she was about to make good on her outstanding loans,